Father John A. Hardin is a well-known author, lecturer, and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises, and is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. The following conference is one of a series of conferences given by Father John Hardin in Oriental religions. Father has for many years studied and taught about these divergent beliefs of the peoples of the world. He is the author of the book, Religions of the World. Father Hardin first engaged in the teaching of these religions to Jesuit scholastics to prepare them for missionary work in the East. Father is a well-known authority in this field and brings out the truth and error in each belief. In the following conference, Father Hardin speaks on the subject, Buddhist Worship and Ritual. Father?
Just a word about an unusual type of monasticism. This is the type found in Tibet. Now, this, of course, has been drastically affected by the communists. And in fact, Tibetan monasticism, I think, best explains the strong motivation which the Marxists had for making such... Hey, Henry, there really was no war, do you know that? Has it occurred to you? There really was no war in the Orient for the communists to take over. They just stepped in. Well, there have been conflicts since, but rather civil war among the people themselves, but there was no mass opposition to the communists. In other words, monasticism had made itself so either disliked or so disrespected, it was just a matter of who would fill the vacuum. Monasticism, therefore, in Tibet is unique, where the religion in the 8th century became an amalgam of Buddhist magic and Tibetan demon worship. The mixture is called Lamaism, from the name Lama, the superior one. Tibet was invited by the Mongols in the 13th century, which marked the beginnings of Lama influence in Mongolia. In other words, the Tibetans had had great influence on China. A certain Khan, he himself was converted in 1261 and centralized the monastic system which later controlled the country. Now, a bit of history which we don't have to go into. But at the death of the Great Lama, who is the leader of the Tibetan Buddhism, a successor would be chosen from a child born near the time of the death of that Great Lama, in whom the god is supposed to have become reincarnate. The infant chosen was taken to the monastery, garbed as a monk at the age of 4. So he was kept. No doubt women took care of him. I suppose his mother came along. At the age of 4, he was clothed in the robes of his office and enthroned. 4 years later, he became a full monk and assumed full authority at 18. Talk about preparing your superiors. Since the communist invasion in China, Vietnam, and Tibet, Buddhist monasticism has been drastically changed. Let me pause here lest I forget. In lecturing on this, and especially when I've got a semester to do it and not just 2 weeks, I naturally spread myself into all sorts of implications, bring in history, and draw out some of the applications that can be made from our understanding of this religion to a better understanding of our own, and of certain movements that have been affected by, or vice versa, in the case of these religions of the East. I mentioned before the break, that Marxism, though it began in Russia, really began at the crossroads of East and West. And the more you know about Russia, the more I think you will agree with me that the basic structure and the mentality of Russia, I mean original continental Russia, is more east than west. Centuries of Mongolian invasions to a point where the Orientals quite took over so much, as you know, of what is now continental Russia. The despotism practiced by the Tsars for centuries was really a Oriental despotism on European soil. People really ask themselves, where does Europe really leave off? Is it at the borders of Russia on the western side, or is it at the Ural Mountains? And really, it could better be said, it closed really at the edge of the western side of Russia. At any rate, when communism took root in Russia, one reason for my profound interest, of course, as I'm sure you know, and I've said this more than once, my own background is in that tradition. My first prayer book was Russian. But as you study the past history of that, and you ask yourself, what happened when Marxism took over in Russia? Well, it began to spread in two directions, or better, it began to attempt to spread in two directions, because Marxism is nothing if not apostolic. It is evangelism of the most militant sort. Well, it did move westward with varying degree of success. But its westward conquest has been hard, I'm speaking from a communist viewpoint, has been hard, scattered, only minimally successful. And at every step in the way, now 50 years, do you know? This year is 50 years. 17 and 67. Talk about living in historic times. During these 50 years, the westward drive of communism has reached, we now know, the Western Hemisphere. Cuba is completely and authentically communist. But it's spotted. It's only here and there. It's always been revolutionary. It's always had a hard time to get in, and often a hard time to survive. In Poland, I'm told it's living a very precarious existence. But the big question is why? The reason why is because, moving westward, it moved in the territory already occupied by Christianity. But its movement has also been eastward, and there the movement has been quiet, serene, and phenomenally successful. And the reason, of course, is because it did not meet a culture or a philosophy that was antithetical to it. Quite the contrary. It met, on the one hand, people, many of whom had been brought up on a kind of secularism that Marxism found a fruitful soil in germinating, and found also, as for example in Tibet and other places too, the monks controlling the land, the property, the lives of the people, and they themselves doing nothing but quite literally staring at their navel for 6 and 8 hours a day and calling it meditation, and between stirrings, living very comfortable lives. No wonder that both theoretically and practically, Marxism had no problem. It just spread over about half of Asia. The present communist population of Asia is around 700 million. Since the communist invasion, therefore, you would expect monasticism to change. That's an understatement. Monasticism to disappear. Some Buddhist institutions have been allowed to function provided they cooperate. According to the land reform laws, the monks may keep as much land as they can cultivate to meet a predetermined quota of crops. Nothing voluntary there. Failure to meet the quota means forfeiture of the land. That's, by the way, also the laws of all political power. Property held, and in the United States, these parentheses I can't keep from making because they keep staring me in the face. In case you don't know, it is not just a movement. It is. It's there. It's in the courts. Most recently, as you know, the Supreme Court had a case before it. All kinds of other cases will keep coming, and the end is clearly in sight. Church-related property will gradually lose more and more of its tax exemption, and the condition, the only condition, for hopefully holding on to our property, that means holding on to it, is being productive and proving to society and to our lawmakers that we deserve tax exemption. City monasteries, now going back to China and Tibet, city monasteries are required to undertake certain manufacturing industries. In Tibet, the great Lama has been driven into exile, and the quasi-religious administration of the country by the Lamas was, by a simple exportation of that one man, taken over by the communists. No problem. The structure was all there. Finally, the laity. Heavy stress on the monastic life. Buddhism has been, in the popular mind, almost identified with cloistered asceticism and segregation from the world. Whereas, first of all, this is not true, because from its earliest history it has shown an awareness of the laity that compares favorably with the most laic religions of the East. Buddha himself taught the laity as well as monks, and he was mindful of the average person's mode of life in society. Furthermore, by his own wishes, the Sangha, the monastic order, developed as an institution within society, supported by it and intended as a source and focus of its religious energy. In other words, in Buddha's original thought, here of course I am quoting the more strict Theravada Buddhism, Buddha's ideal was that society needs leadership. In this case, religious leadership. That kind of leadership cannot be developed except by separation from the maelstrom of normal social intercourse. He therefore got his own disciples around him, at first only men, later because of his aunt's pleadings, also women, who followed him, who gradually began to live somewhat together. But the idea was that their work, and in fact their own reaching of nirvana, was conditioned on their sharing their own insights, their own way of achieving that nirvana goal with others outside of the monastery. Consequently, in view of this already in Buddha, Buddhist literature often represents guidance and examples for the laity, and not just for the monks. Even when the monks or the nuns are mainly concerned, to a great extent, the Dharma, now just to remember this word, D-H-A-R-M-A, to a great extent, the Dharma, which is the teachings of the Buddha, which wishes doctrine, the laws, can be interpreted as well singularly as plurally. In other words, either as referring to the monks of the monastic order, or the plurality of mankind. At the same time, Buddhism has absorbed numerous social customs and beliefs from other religions and has integrated them into the stream of its own tradition, with the result that what originally and theoretically is still a monastic religion, Buddhism at its heart is monasticism. Yet it has become laicized to a degree undreamed of, even in religions that don't pretend to be monastic. Every aspect of Buddhist life and thought is now open in greater or less measure to all segments of the population. However, as you would expect, there are differences, notably between the two main forms of Buddhism, between the Hinayana, therefore, and Mahayana forms, where the historical cleavage naturally affects the place which the laity occupy. The classic Pali scriptures for the guidance of laypersons have deeply influenced Buddhist practices in South Asia. In symbolic language, the Buddhist councils express what are substantially the same principles which bind the monk. You might say lay perfection or perfection for the laity. They are generic enough to allow adaptation to particular customs and susceptible to many interpretations as commentaries reveal. In context, and this is one passage I want to quote at some length, you will get the language, you will get some of the ways in which the things that we talked about when we examined, remember that eightfold path, how it is lived out outside the monastery. This is supposed to be the Buddha talking. He is ostensibly talking about a young householder whom he instructs to protect the six quarters, which he proceeds to identify. Parents are the eastern quarter, teachers the south, wife and children the west, friends and companions are the north. Servants and workpeople represent the nadir, while religious teachers and monks are the zenith. What's the difference? So there are six, the four points of the compass, and these two that we've just mentioned. In five ways, I'm just quoting one section. In five ways a child should minister to his parents as his eastern quarter. And you will see the respect for ancestors coming out here. Once supported by them, I will now be their support. I will perform duties incumbent on them. Incumbent on them, that's the accent. I will keep up the lineage and tradition of my family. I will make myself worthy of my heritage. See, this is the child-parent relationship. And in five ways, parents, thus ministered to by their child, show their love for him. So this describes the parent-child relationship. They restrain the child from vice, exhort him to virtue, train him to a profession, contract a suitable marriage for him, and in due time, they hand over his inheritance. In five ways, pupils minister to their teachers. This, by the way, I always teach with great gusto. In five ways, pupils minister to their teachers as the southern quarter, by rising from their seat in salutation, by waiting upon them, by eagerness to learn, by personal service, and by attention when receiving their teaching. And then for emphasis, I repeat this. And in five ways do teachers, this by the way would be worth remembering, thus minister to love their pupil. They train him in that wherein he has been well trained by his parents. In other words, the presumption there is a prior training by the parents, and the teachers take over. They make him hold fast that which is well held, so they develop conviction. They thoroughly instruct him in the love of every art. This, by the way, is, I think, a new thought. It's oriental. Not teach him every art, but teach him the love of every art. They speak well of him among his friends and companions. They speak well of him. They provide for his safety in every quarter. In other words, they protect him from the conflict and hostility he is sure to meet. Let's just mention one more and be done with what goes on for pages. In like manner, the wife, as Western quarter, should be cared for by the husband, by respect, by courtesy, by fidelity, by handing over authority to her. Sounds strange. By providing her with adornment, of course. And he in turn ought to be served by the wife, performing her duties well. Here's a pleasant thought. By hospitality to his parents and hers. By fidelity. By watching over the goods he brings home. And by skill and industry in all that she does. A faithful Buddhist, therefore, will practice virtue towards his friends and familiars. This would be the northern quarter. With regard to servants and employees, the nadir of virtue is concern. Why nadir? Because they are on the lowest social scale. They are to be assigned, let me quote, work according to their strength, supplied with food and wages, tended in their sickness, receive a share in unusual delicacies, and occasionally given vacation. And the adverb, I'm told, is in the original Sanskrit, occasionally. The employees, for their part, are to love their master. They rise before him. They lie down to rest after him. They are content with what is given to them. They do their work well. And they carry about his praise and good name. They never speak ill of him. Now the layman fulfills his duties towards religious teachers and monks by affection in act and speech and mind, by keeping open house to them and by supplying them with temporal needs. In other words, monasticism in Buddhism is taken care of by the laity. In like manner, the recluses, that is the Brahmins and the priests, who somehow span Hinduism and Buddhism, show their love for the layman if they restrain him from evil, exhort him to good, love him with kindly thoughts, teach him what he has not heard, correct and purify what he has heard, and reveal to him the way to nirvana. The laity, we said, differ in the relationship to the monastery depending on whether it is northern or southern Buddhism. In general, the relationship in the north is more the nature of moral and financial support of the monasteries. In the south, the integration is much closer, particularly in that the monks and the nuns are the teachers and in that sense the spiritual formers of the laity. And also, especially among the boys, youngsters from the age of 6 or 7 will be put into monastic schools. Obviously, it does not affect too many. On the other hand, those who are so or have been so affected are among the most influential. And consequently, there is a close integration between monastic life and the laity, especially in southeastern Asia. We mentioned that the laity are allowed to look forward to what would correspond to our Christian and for them Buddhist perfection. Now, there are many things that could be said. There is one name I have on your notes, I believe. Vimalakirti. who is often described in their Buddhist literature as a symbol of the ideals of the laity. He was a disciple of Buddha, and his name is a household word in Buddhist circles as the ideal of a layman who achieved greater holiness than most persons attain by following even the monastic discipline. A place was reserved on the court calendar in Japan for reading and expounding the text which tells the story of his virtues. Quotation, praised by all the Buddhas. By now you realize that the Buddhists do aspire to becoming Buddhas. Revered by all the disciples and all the gods, his memory has been kept alive as the model of lay sanctity. Then the following quotation from a modern commentator on lay Buddhist virtue, speaking of this man. Though he is but a simple layman, yet observing the pure monastic discipline, notice the pattern. Though living at home, yet never desirous of anything. Though possessing a wife and children, always exercising pure virtues. Though surrounded by his family, holding aloof from worldly pleasures. Though using the jeweled ornaments of the world, yet adorned with spiritual splendor. Though eating and drinking, yet enjoying the flavor of the rapture of meditation. Though frequenting the gambling house, yet leading the gamblers into the right path. Though coming in contact with heresy, yet never letting his true faith be impaired. Though having a profound knowledge of worldly learning, yet ever finding pleasure in things of the spirit as taught by Buddha, except for the word Buddha, I'm sure any Christian could buy that pattern of virtue. Now, Mahayana, as we said, this is the popular form of Buddhism, is, of course, the most popular and tends not to be speculative. Yet it can also be philosophical. However, when it approaches the laity, who are, of course, the mass of the people, it avoids speculation. You do not find, for example, treatises on Buddhist faith or even Buddhist virtue much, if any, for the laity. It is usually in terms of personalities holding up as examples or paragons of virtue great Buddhist laymen or laywomen. His fame of this man, that is indicative of a tendency in this type of Buddhism that has the merit of ready appeal to many of people of the world, but the disadvantage of being subject, as you would expect, to their own interpretations of how they should imitate a man like this. It was this easy adaptation that has made Northern Mahayana Buddhism more sectarian, and I should add, more secularist than its Southern counterparts, and created divisions and subdivisions within the Buddhist ranks, which are at present so prevalent in the North. Japan, in many ways, is both the best example we have of this, and for us the most relevant, because we are so deeply involved, the United States, in Japan, and we have easiest access to its culture. It's a good example of both the sectarianism and secularization. Historically, six sects were introduced from China between the middle 7th and middle 8th centuries AD. And these have now grown into close to 100 distinct bodies, which are further divided into smaller units. A book like Horner's Religion in Japan is baffling in its complexities. I have currently been doing something on trying to organize in my mind for publication Protestant sectarianism or denominationalism. It's nothing compared to the myriad divisions in Japan. For example, the narrow sects, which are really a body of many sects, arose through their patronage of the wealthy aristocratic classes. The so-called Tendai groups, which have been popularized in modern magazines, were the result of embracing the popular Shinto deities into the Buddhist pantheon. And therefore, most non-Christian Japanese are Buddhist in their religion, particularly on the ritual side, and Shinto in their faith. Shingon, again, known to many American readers, catered to the mystical and esoteric tastes of the people. There is one type, however, that I want to say a little more about, and I refer to it somewhere, I think, towards the end of your notes, namely the Amida sect. Nowhere else is the lay character of Buddhism better seen than in the Amida, A-M-I-D-A, sect. There are at least six different spellings of this. That is the Amida. Named after Amitabha, or Amiteus, Japanese Amida, one of the Buddhas. You see what happened, therefore, Buddhism, allowing for people to reach enlightenment, that is, people in the past to reach enlightenment, if they had, by popular standards, been outstanding, well, believers in Buddhism, and had practiced the Eightfold Path, after they died, quotation marks, it was then believed they had reached Nirvana. What else would you expect? Or if they hadn't, at least that they became bodhisattvas. In any case, the tendency then, and the polytheistic tendency, is strong. By the way, and this, let me insert a parenthesis, is strong in human nature. I know nothing stronger in human nature than the urge to polytheism. And Western culture is not exempt from that. It's only that our language is more sophisticated. The varieties of apotheoses, deifications, into which our Western culture has lapsed are myriad, not the least of which is the sovereign and all but almighty state. We are much too shrewd to say that we're developing a religion. I want to make sure that we don't underestimate, or how shall I say, undercut, or somehow attribute naive stupidity to the Orientals, with all these gods here in this case, of course, making Buddhas of all sorts of things. For example, deifying the Japanese emperor. Sisters, the Western world had done this for centuries. And I mark my words. Close parentheses. It was founded, this particular influential Japanese sect, the Amida, by the priest Honen, H-O-N-E-N, who lived 1132 to 1212. This is worth knowing because this is the kind of Buddhism that you don't have to speculate about, because millions, numbers are unaccountable here. I suppose, 200 or so million, not of course only in Japan, who studied all the sects of his day and became discouraged over the difficulty of attaining true enlightenment. Time is passing on, he said to himself, and I have not yet reached Nirvana. Then he came on a simple and effective way of universal salvation, and how familiar this sounds to Western ears. A single passage in the sacred writings, he said, or discovered, held the secret. Quote from him, "Whether walking or standing, sitting or lying down, only repeat the name of Amida with all your heart. Never cease the practice of it, even for a moment. This is the very work which unfailingly issues in salvation, for it is in accordance with the original vow of that Buddha." Amida was, it is believed, a historical personage who had, because of his great fidelity to Buddhism, attained Buddhahood. Honen started a movement on the basis of this vow, that is, which Amida himself had bid his followers to practice, teaching that the mere recitation of the phrase, worth memorizing, adoration of the Lord of boundless light and infinite light, that phrase, the recitation of it, would give final assurance of rebirth in the pure land, which of course makes nirvana a little less than desireless non-existence, if it were accompanied by faith. Talk about faith without good works. I repeat, this must be the 10th time. There is no greater benefit accrued from the study of comparative religion, there are many other benefits, than to settle down quietly and say, well, I have seen this before, and to give you a hold on human nature in its attempt to reach the divine that I frankly don't believe, at least this kind of insight, is possible by studying only, although we believe, the true faith of Jesus Christ.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.